ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
You're a cop. What do you want?
I need your help.
Replicants are the future.
We should own the world.
What's the plan?
We have to stop him. Buckle up.
Where is he?
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad, is he or is he not a real boy, Riley.
That has always been my question. I have got to tell you, this is the fulcrum of my life. Am I or am I not a real boy?
It's true. Chad is a fan of Philip K. Dick's work, and so are we, as we are going to be reviewing the new sequel to last week's conversation that we had. So stick around. The film Philmlosophers is presented with a lingering eye for beautiful symbolism by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Like a detective perusing archives of data, you can access every episode of The Filmlosophers on Libsyn, Google Play, Player FM, Audio Boom, iTunes, or Stitcher. Anytime, any day. New episodes debut on Wednesday. When you need to confirm that your memories are really yours, social media is a great place to look. It's also a great place to connect with The Filmlosophers. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to keep updated on news and views from Tinseltown and beyond. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Mike Self, and I. Like I said, we got a great show in store, and if this is actually a continuation of last week's conversation, as we said, we were going to make this a two-parter ultimately because of the fact that we talked about the first film, Blade Runner, from 1982 last week, and in episode 82, Lesson 82, ironically, which we found out is also the same year that the film
debuted.
I
mean, I think it was fate. It was meant to be. Were we programmed?
Right. Was
to
this
make
already
that
preordained by some creator?
Wow, that was like a Yoda. That was like a little Yoda utterance there.
Created, are we? No, but
it was better when you weren't using words.
It's true. But this is the second part to our two-part sci-fi fun series, as we are going to be discussing Blade Runner 2049. The film just debuted this past Friday, and it's kind of having a really interesting opening weekend.
Yeah, they didn't get the results that they wanted for the opening weekend. They're hoping word of mouth might push things forward a little bit more at the box office.
True. In Blade Runner 2049, Officer K, a new Blade Runner from the Los Angeles Police Department, unearths a long-buried secret that has the potential to plunge what's left of society into chaos. His discovery leads him on a quest to find Rick Deckard, a former Blade Runner who's been missing for 30 years. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, the film stars Ryan Gosling, Robin Wright, Harrison Ford, Ana de Armas, Jared Leto, and Sylvia Hoeks. The film is a sequel, like we said, to the 1982 sci-fi film we talked in length about last week. Composer Johan Johansson.
I don't think they do that sound, but I did it anyway.
That's a very interesting sound. Was attached to compose the film, the music for the film, however. However, in August 2017, he dropped out from the project for unknown reasons, and composer Hans Zimmer, along with Benjamin Walfish, were hired to replace Johansson.
Hold on, wait a minute. Like, literally in August of this year?
Mm-hmm.
So they figured out how to finalize. It had to be 90% done.
Oh, I have no doubt that the majority of the film's composition was already done.
I mean, the film was basically finished at that point.
It had to have been in the can.
They screened for the press in, like, what, mid-September, the first round.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that is not a long turnaround time.
Well, when you're good at your job, you know.
I guess so.
So, like we said, this is a film that has been kind of the interesting point of the dynamic of this show because of the fact of the two varying sides that we both have about it. I happen to have a deep love and admiration and just an affinity to this film, starting from the original.
I was going
to
say, you're talking about the original.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Or the franchise, I guess.
And I have a deep-seated annoyance.
He does. He actually will not see it unless we are going to be talking about it, which
true
was the case last week. But
there's a reason for that, and her name is Daryl Hannah.
Well, we can both agree on that, but I can look past
Daryl. Yeah, I know. Hannah. You're a better man than I am.
I try. You know, it takes work. But
so basically, we're taking the long-winded way of telling everyone, if you want to hear a quick recap and synopsis of the first movie, you're not going to have that here. You should go listen to the previous episode if you want to get caught up on the world of Blade Runner before seeing the movie, or even after seeing the movie. I mean, I think there's still a lot that bears explaining, even after a movie that's, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes long like this one.
Yeah, we dig a little deeper into the original film, and we cover a lot of interesting thoughts and even inspirations for the film that we theorize and we kind of hypothesize about the first film. There's not going to be a lot of digging into that. We're just kind of going to be focusing on the film at hand, which is the sequel. So, yeah, like Chad said, if you want to catch all that, visit the previous episode. So, like we said, this is a film that had been largely talked about, not just this year, but even last year, ever since the announcement of the sequel. And seeing as somebody like Denis Villeneuve was going to be at the helm for it, it was kind of an interesting choice because of the fact that the only thing I was, at the time, familiar with him doing was Sicario prior to that. But shortly thereafter, he debuted with another movie that actually took a lot of people by surprise, which was Arrival. And we talked,
including us.
We talked in great length about that film when it debuted. And I think for me, that kind of subsided a lot of the worries that I originally had when it came to this director coming in and touching a franchise that, or touching a film, and wanting to create a sequel that had been pretty much sitting on the shelf for like 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are some people like you who were huge, tremendous fans of Blade Runner and to various levels of vocality have wanted a sequel or a follow-up of some sort for many, many years, but it's been so long.
Yeah.
I mean, 30 years is a long time. 35
years
almost. 35 years,
actually, yeah.
Is a long time, and so essentially, there was very little hope that that was ever going to happen. And then suddenly, here comes this announcement that they are going to do a sequel. And, you know, like you said, it was an interesting directorial choice. They kept a lot of things under wraps during production. And the rollout of information leading up to this film has been very measured, very controlled in terms of, you get still images, but not footage for a while. You get some footage, but it doesn't tell you what the story is about. You get some storyline, but it still doesn't give you, you know, enough insight. And even to the point of, you went to a press screening for this that nobody invited me to. And you were so you were able to see it a little early.
Yeah.
And you were one of those, as you know, if you've been, dear listeners, if you've been hearing other podcasts, reading other blogs and reviews and things, you may have heard already that the Warner Brothers team, and apparently Denis Villeneuve directly, essentially made a list of things that they did not want you guys to talk about before the movie actually came out for general audiences.
It's like, true.
Talk about your impressions of what you liked and some general talking points, but don't reveal this plot point, this plot point, this plot point, or this. And it was a fairly long list. I mean, it's not like they were saying, well, there's just this one twist near the end that we don't want you to give away. I mean, they gave you like a grocery list of things to not bring up in your reviews until it actually bowed at the box office over the weekend.
Yeah, what was so?
Which means we can talk about all of it.
Exactly. What was said was that the representative from the studio had stated that the studios themselves, as well as, like you said, the director, had a very explicit message in terms of saying when you leave the theater, these are all key, and they're all key elements of the film that, you know, are part of the major plot point. But it was they said, for the interest of the viewers who have not seen the film, we want them to experience the film in its fullness. And so, and they were very, very like big brotherish. They're like, just so you know, there, everybody's going to be watching. We're going to be looking for your reviews, and we're going to be. So they, you know, they really wanted to make sure that the people who were reading the reviews weren't going to have anything even remotely spoiled or hinted at, because they wanted everything from the beginning of the film all the way to the end to be a fresh experience for the moviegoer.
Which sounds all well and good, and I'm sure that, you know, from an artistic standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. I think, having now seen the film, because I was able to hear from you, like, hey, they gave us this list of things that we can't talk about. Now having seen the film, it makes it, I guess, in a more practical way, like artistically, sure, you don't want the cat out of the bag on some of your special tricks and things that go on, although we are going to be, you know, spoiler rich. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want to be spoiled, then be forewarned. We are going to talk about things that are on that list because the movie is out in the theater and you can easily go and watch it and then come back and listen to us later. Anyway, having seen the film, from a practical standpoint, I can actually see, beyond the artistic reasons, like, basically what I'm saying is this: there's not a lot of plot to this movie, and quite a few of the plot points are, to some degree, a bit twisty. There are more than one that happen, and so there's a let's call it a continuum of experience that you go through when you're in the audience. And so you get, you know, you hit this twist and you feel this way, and then you hit that one and you feel that way, and then you hit this other one and you feel this way again. And, you know, so there's kind of a bit of a roller coaster motion to what your mind is doing, maybe your emotions as well. But really, this movie, it really does take its time to tell you the story that it's telling. If you were to distill all the major plot points down to, let's say, an outline, you know, 1A, Officer K goes here and finds this person. 1B, they fight. You know, and you were to just very basically script it out, it would be, I don't know, 10, maybe 12 pages
of
plot points, not dialogue, not how beautiful it is, not what the music's doing for you, not what the costumes look like, and all these amazing, beautiful, phenomenal, highly technically proficient elements that we're going to talk about in a little bit. But if you were looking at just the plot, I would say probably 50% of it was on that list of things on your sheet, because there really isn't. It's not a complicated plot.
No, it's actually really basic in terms of what the overall structure of the film is trying to convey in terms of story. Everything else in between is like we were saying, scenery, artistic perspective on terms of the original film and allowing that to transition into a modern day audience. And like I said, we'll get into more of that. But it's true. The majority of what was on that page were literally every major point of the entire film.
Right.
And it's now that I'm thinking about it, it's true. Had we said anything in that on that page, it would have ruined the entire movie.
Well, and people who were looking for something within the experience of the story that was new, all they would have would be the imagery or the sound.
Yeah,
you know, because a lot of the experience is, you know, what does the environment make you think about or make you feel or whatever. You know, it's not really contingent upon the dialogue or the direct actions of the characters. It's the world that they're inhabiting, and really allowing that world to come to life before your very eyes. There's a lot in many sequences in this 2 hour and 45 minute long film. There are a lot of silent, extended silences of looking, thinking, evaluating, and just you as an audience member observing the environment, which is really rare to come across. I mean, you know, it's overly talked about how short our attention spans are these days and how they're getting shorter all the time. And we want instant gratification and, you know, that kind of frenetic. I mean, we see what The Super Frenetic does, and that's, you know, a Michael Bay kind of movie.
Oh my gosh.
Which we would not want.
Nope.
For something like this that's made to make you think. This movie slows things down considerably and does not rush through any of the elements of the plot. It really takes its time, but I think part of it is because it's taking its time also to invite you into the world that the characters are inhabiting. I mean, I think personally it would have made for a tremendous like virtual reality experience for you to actually walk through the streets of the city.
Oh, okay. See,
you know, actually, you know, look kind of all around the, I don't know, the gallery of the replicant bodies and like whatever, all the things that are going on, to fully inhabit the frame as an audience member would have been a really good use of the time that you spend with nothing, like literally nothing happening in front of you aside from observation.
And it's true that when you kind of compare it to the original film, obviously the original film isn't as long. It stands at about an hour and 54 minutes, hour and 50 minutes. This film, like we said, is 2 hours and 45 minutes, so it's quite a bit longer. And so coming into the film, that was one of the things that I was expecting to be the biggest downside to the film, right even before the film started.
The running time?
The running time, because talking with the other members of the press, we're sitting there and we're like, man, 2 hours and 45 minutes. And some of them were like, well, you know, that's a lot of time to blossom a story. That's a lot of time to do this. But it's kind of a double-edged sword because simultaneously having too much time could also take away from the story. It could elongate what kind of narrative could have been done in less time. It could draw that out and cause it to not be as impactful as, you know, the moments they wanted them to be impactful. So that was my first kind of walking into the theater and thinking, okay, one of the things that will make or break this film will be its running time. And knowing Denis Villeneuve and his experience with working in terms of with time with Arrival, we know that he is a man who likes to pay attention to the details, but he likes to also leave the details in the entire scene, which is why he lingers on certain, you know, scenes a little too long. He'll allow for like a scene of a bird in a cage to linger for a while because the importance of the bird and what's going on, and so forth. And so you I half expected that, okay, if the running time is going to be this long, it's probably because it's going to be more along the lines of his artistic outlet for this film rather than it being, you know, just a drawn out film. I was really wanting to give a lot of like credit to Denis Villeneuve. I really wanted to say this man is, you know, knows what he's going to do and he's going to handle it. And,
yeah, I would agree. I mean, we've you know, as mentioned a couple minutes ago, we saw Arrival last year and did a review episode about it. And I mean, that for me, the experience, not necessarily the movie, the experience of being an audience member in that movie the first time was very like visceral. Like I remember feeling at the end of that movie
mm-hmm.
and thinking, how in the world did they just pull that off? That is incredible. Meanwhile, some other people in the theater were sitting there scratching their heads like, wait a minute. So the aliens were real, right? And they like that, you know, like there, I think that there's a certain level of his storytelling and what he hones in on and how he likes to tell the story without literally spelling everything out for you
mm-hmm.
that can come off as a bit obscure for a general audience, you know,
yeah.
And that's not to say that people generally are not smart, but just he does linger on details and he does
it's
want
true.
You to be highly active in experiencing the story that's kind of laid out like a beautiful menu in front of you. And if you're not fully engaged, you're going to miss some things and you're probably going to like miss maybe the whole point of it. And you're going to think at the end, wait, what was the point of this? Why did you just spend so much time? I thought the aliens were invading, you know, or, you know, in this case, I don't know what you would think, but, so having come from that experience and still have, it's pretty fresh. I mean, it was a year ago that movie came out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's still very fresh. The magic of having that movie go the way that it went, Arrival. And so I stepped into the theater and I'm like, you know, okay, granted it's 2 hours and 45 minutes long. When you had seen it earlier, I knew how excited you were about it, and how just amped up you could not wait. You probably got to the theater like 4 hours early, even though you had a press pass, which means that you can just waltz right in. And that's awesome. And that enthusiasm. And afterward, I remember asking you, well, you know, how was it? And you were a bit ambivalent.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear that you liked it, but you weren't still gushing the way that you were before you went into the theater.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had that in the back of my mind, like, oh, Eddie, that, you know, is one of the people in this world that this movie was made for, came back with a measured response.
Yeah.
Not an exuberant response, but a measured response. And that was an indicator to me that, uh-oh, for somebody like Chad, who was already annoyed by the first movie, don't hate people, don't hate. There were things about the first movie, Daryl Hannah, that did annoy me. And I've not watched it hardly ever because of that factor, but I had great hopes because of Denis Villeneuve
mm-hmm.
And because of Arrival specifically. And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, Eddie's response was measured. It's a long movie. Maybe I'm going to love it. I mean, that was honestly, I was like, I bet I'm going to love this movie. I bet that this movie doesn't really so much continue what the first one did as present something, you know, fresh and new and more in line with what was going on in Arrival, which I really appreciated. And then I proceeded in the beginning of this film. I'm going to throw myself under the bus.
Knock yourself out.
I proceeded for the first time in history. Part of this is my own fault. And if you weren't hating me before, you're going to start now. In the first 20 minutes of this film, I fell asleep for off and on for probably about 5 to 10 minutes of the first maybe 25 minutes of this movie because it was so slow getting started. Which is remarkable because there's a fight sequence in there. You're introduced mm-hmm. to a bunch of characters, to the whole world, and yet something about the pacing just was not connecting with me. And I was frustrated about it, obviously not frustrated enough to keep my eyes open. You know, so I don't know, about 25 minutes in, you're jostling me on the arm, you know, saying, dude, you're starting to breathe heavily. You need to cut that out. I was awake for the rest of the movie.
That was an interesting moment in a theater. I don't think I've ever had to do that to anybody. So thank you for that.
I've never done that before. I've never fallen all the way asleep. Like I've been drowsy before and I've wanted to fall asleep. There have been some movies that I've wanted to walk out of because they were terrible. This was kind of the perfect storm. I was drowsy going in. It was really slow getting started. And I just couldn't, it could not keep my attention for a while.
Hmm.
Which is a shame because there is actually a lot to appreciate about, you know, aside from the pacing and the function of the plot, there's a lot to appreciate artistically about the look and feel of the entire thing.
Oh, yeah.
The team that worked on this film is incredible and deserves a lot of support and acclaim for what they did in terms of, I mean, the cinematography, the lighting. Oh, my gosh. Some of those sequences in, with Jared Leto's workshop area.
Yeah.
Where the lighting is moving on both characters on a two shot with some like the lighting work, the level of detail that it's mind blowing. It is so incredibly cool. Some of the stuff that's going on visually in this movie. But it doesn't really move very fast.
Those are true words. It is. And it's not to the fault of the overall story itself. The overall story, like we said, it doesn't need to be pulled out that much. It didn't need to be drawn out. The story itself could have fit within the time frame of less than 2 hours. Maybe at the most, 2 hours, an hour 45. It could have fit within that time frame easily. But because of the constant pauses to admire the snow or the look of a large, what seems to be a boiler area of a large ship, or looking at the landscape of what used to be Las Vegas, or looking at all these scenes, because of the fact that there's such a push for the artistic look of the film, that causes what could easily be 5, maybe 10 minute scenes to be drawn out to 30 minute scenes easily. That is probably one of its bigger flaws of the film, but just, I don't know. It's one of those things where for me, I don't mind a longer story if the story is consistently being fed to the viewer. Like if it's just like a steady chain of information that's being given, even if there's time in between, I'm kind of like the long game kind of guy. I don't mind longer films. I don't mind, like we've talked about it, like mini series that lasts like 4 hours or whatever. I don't know. I think
nor do I actually. I mean, it's highly odd what happened to me in the movie theater over the weekend, and it's not entirely the film's fault. I mean, I came in tired, and I probably should have just taken a nap before I came. But at the same time, if it had moved a little bit faster, I don't think that would have happened. Again, the failing is mostly mine, but I do think it bears mentioning that, as you mentioned, it really could fit in under 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, easily.
I don't know. Maybe there's an argument to be made for making a film that has equal weight given to the setting as to the plot, the sense of place. Where are you? Not just what are you doing or who are you while you're doing it, but where are you? And maybe that was one of the points that artistically they were wanting to make with this film, because you're right. Most of the scenes that drag out are establishing shots.
Yeah.
Or transitional shots that are mostly based on the look of an environment.
Yeah.
They're
or the
not
passing
really,
of a building or a... Yeah.
You're not necessarily sitting there watching Ryan Gosling like look around. You have a little bit of that, and then you as the audience are looking around and seeing, broad vistas or, small contained apartment areas or, like whatever. You've got a variety of different settings, and maybe that was part of the point.
And the thing is that it works when the film's story needs it to work. Like if the plot that's being driven incorporates more of the cinematography in each scene, if it incorporates more of that in terms of the overall story that's being driven, then yeah, it works. But in the case of just being artistic and wanting to show, let's have the wide shot of Vegas here while the drone's going here, and then let's see this, and then let's see that, and then let's see this, and then let's zoom in here. Mm-hmm. That there's that particular scene that goes on for far too long, just to establish there's something going on in Vegas, ultimately. Right. And it's funny that you were saying, you know, in terms of not who's in the scene, but also where the scene is being taken place. And immediately my mind went to films like Apocalypto, just mm-hmm. in terms of us with previous, you know, Columbus Day and everything like that, in fresh in my mind.
Is that why?
It just fresh in my mind. But that type of film had incredible establishing shots, not just for the sake of where you are, but the environment plays a key role in the overall story.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, the person who is established as the main character has to go through that same forest whom he is most comfortable with because he's from that forest, just to get away from people who are after him. And a lot of those establishing shots that are created in the very first couple of scenes are revisited later on because of the comfort of that particular character. So that in that context, it works. In this context here, there's just a little bit of time that is kind of wasted. And it's sad to say that it's wasted, but it truly is, because there's no reason for so much time to be taken when somebody is exiting a building during a snowy period, and it takes them about 15 minutes just to get down the steps, down some area where the snow is, look at the snowfall, look up at the sky, and then 15 minutes later, the scene transitions over into the next scene, which could have easily been maybe a 4 or 5 minute scene.
Yeah.
So I do have to say that is one of the things that does, you know, harm the film.
Well, and you definitely have certain segments, certain sequences, which I don't want to bounce around plot-wise, but you eventually make your way to Las Vegas, and mm-hmm. you don't know at first that it's Las Vegas. You figure that out kind of as you go, and you've got clues in the scene that indicate that to you, but like you said, it takes forever mm-hmm. to just say, yep, guys, we're in Vegas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially... It is almost 5 minutes, it feels like, of establishing shots at varying degrees of, you know, wide or close angles or medium shots. But then in Vegas, there's a sequence in a lounge with holograms and the visuals and the sound, and it's going in and out. And I mean, it is jarring as all get out, but it's also completely captivating. And it's a great example of the environment reflecting something about the characters or sharing an important element of the story that is never going to be covered in the dialogue. The characters aren't going to say this out loud, you know, but there's sort of a commentary on, you know, the validity of memory being fragmented and, you know, what you feel nostalgic about and, like, you know, kind of the throwback historical figures that are represented in that sequence. You know, there's a lot that you can pull from when you want to sit there and really dig in. I don't know that simply going to a movie theater and experiencing the movie is really... I don't know that most people in a modern audience are going to look to sit down and really just intellectually dig in
yeah.
on their first viewing. I think that's especially something that's left more for, like, your third viewing on DVD at home.
Especially after when that particular scene comes into the fray, you are well after your 2-hour mark.
Oh, yeah.
So when this
one of our main characters is introduced just shy of 2 hours
yeah.
into the film, which is honestly mind-boggling.
Yeah. And speaking of characters, obviously the cast that is in this film isn't exactly what was in the first film. Obviously, 35 years does play a you know, a little
certainly
bit of a
does.
Role in that. So we do have Harrison Ford reprising his role as Rick Deckard, as well as Edward James Olmos reprising his role as Gaff.
Yep.
Which was
briefly,
but it was still a quick high point for me. I got excited for that. But
and somehow, like, dressed oddly like Colonel Sanders. Did you pick up on that? I'm like, what is the deal with the
technically
Colonel Sanders
that's
outfit?
That's the way he dressed in the first film, except he didn't have his little fedora hat that he usually wears.
Yeah, that would have helped.
Edward James Olmos, he's the best.
He is the best. I have nothing against that man. That man is gold.
But you do have a lot of new characters in this one as well, with Ryan Gosling playing Agent Officer K, Robin Wright, who is the madam or the woman in charge, the captain, I guess, or the whoever's in charge of the police force.
I was going to say, it's very interesting that you call her a madam.
Well, that's what they consider her, or that's what Officer K calls her.
I mean, it's not entirely, there a case could be made.
I don't remember her title or name.
Well, just, you know, a madam is...
I know. You know. I know.
Runs a brothel, and in a way, because at least one of the people working for her is a replicant. I mean, it the whole, like, I'm over you and I own you and you do my bidding. I mean, there is a dynamic there that actually True. Does fit.
She's a lieutenant. My bad.
The subtext actually would not be entirely off base, especially given that at one point she even seems to be propositioning.
Yes.
Him later on. But
we also have Jared Leto, who plays Wallace, the head of the corporation of Wallace Corp. So, which don't really expect
the,
too much.
The new creepy corporation that took over from the old creepy corporation.
Yeah. Quick side note. Jared Leto does creepy really well.
He really does.
You know, whether or not if he's, you know, playing some interesting pretty boy in Fight Club, or he's playing a drug dealer in the Dallas Buyers Club, or he likes a lot of clubs, playing the Joker in Suicide Squad, whatever it may be.
Or as the front man for 30 Seconds to Mars.
Or as the front man. Jared Leto really does creepy really well. And in this film, he's more of like a philosopher type.
Yeah, I mean, he basically...
Eccentric.
He literally bought out and took over the Tyrell Corporation. And now he's trying to improve upon the genetics of the replicants so that they can self-replicate. So that they can have children of their own, because he sees it as the only way that they could ever outpace the, you know, normal baseline human population.
Yeah.
Because right now they're used as slaves, as servants. They're a lower caste within the society, and they're tasked to do things, same as the first film. They're tasked to do things that, you know, the humans don't want to do. And the humans, you know, don't want them to form a society of their own, but that's what he wants.
Yeah. Ultimately, there was a few short films that came out before this film came out, and one of the unique parts of it was that Wallace promised other people that these replicants were going to obey. He gives an example of this as the replicant that he had with him. He orders him to kill himself, and he ends up killing himself in front of the people that he's trying to get, you know, the funds for. So the idea is that he wants to create his own version of replicants in a fashion that, like you said, they can self-replicate, so that he doesn't have to worry about mass producing, when he can create a certain population and then they will go ahead and, you know, create more.
Right.
All this is alluded to as, and we did say there were going to be spoilers. So,
yes.
All this
is... We're heading into heavy spoiler territory.
So that was the car coming in, and the spoiler train has left the station. So this
cars is, and trains, I love it.
So this is where Ryan Gosling's character, Officer K, finds a box of a human skeleton, which happens to be the remains of character Sean Young from the first film, who played Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually her skeletal remains, and it looks as though she had passed away while giving birth. Now, the notion is that at the end of Blade Runner, the first film, Rick Deckard and Rachel run away together. And it's also been established, we talked about this last week, that Rick Deckard is also a replicant. So,
but doesn't know it.
But doesn't know it.
Through the... Well, through the original entire cut of the first film, and even through the bulk of the story as told in future, you know, like what, Final Cut, Director's Cut?
Final Cut.
I don't remember which one actually establishes that, oh yeah, he was a replicant the whole time, didn't you know?
So
it's his eyes, right? They make his eyes kind of do that weird glow thing that the replicant's eyes do.
Yes, sir. So they ultimately find her remains. They establish that she's actually had a baby and that she died while giving birth. And so this blows the mind of the lieutenant, who tells Officer K, who happens to be a replicant.
And knows that he is,
that he needs to put a lid on this, that they need to not let this leak out into the open, because if people found out that there is no wall between humans and replicants, then there's going to be a war. And so Officer K goes on this long search for what happened to the child. The Wallace Corporation catches wind, and Wallace himself sends his own angel, which is what he calls her, who's named Love, to go and find the child as well. So she goes. She's like a tank. This woman literally karate chops a man to death with one fail swoop.
Yeah, she is. She's a considerable character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which is why I don't understand why she didn't get top billing. Because I would have seen Ryan Gosling, the Sylvia Hoax, Robin Wright. I mean, she should have been up there with them.
She should have been, yeah. I mean, she's one of the main... They interviewed her at the conventions and press junkets and stuff. I mean, she's one of the main characters, but it really doesn't... There was a lot that they hid from us before the movie. I mean, that's what it amounts to. They didn't want to let the cat out of the bag in any way. Because I remember at Comic-Con, I remember watching... Well, I wasn't in the room, but I remember watching the Comic-Con panel afterward, and they were asking both her and Ana de Armas, okay, so who do you play? Like, what are you doing? And they basically were like, you know, we're characters in this story. We can't really tell anything about who we are or what we do. But we had a great time on the set. It was great working with these other performers. Yeah. And like, they had to completely dodge. And I don't know that I completely understand why in retrospect. Like, why can't one of them say, I'm a replicant character, and the other one says, I'm a computer program? You know, I don't know why they couldn't say that, but it was pretty significantly.
I think in the character of Love's character, it would have taken away from the antagonist role of Wallace, which is being portrayed in every trailer and in every teaser out there for the film. If it looks as though Jared Leto is not the one who's kind of behind all the craziness, like he's not the one who's actually, you know, in the midst of all the craziness and someone else is, then they become the bad guy and he's just some blind guy stuck in the dark somewhere.
He's the puppet master.
Yeah.
Although in a way she is too. I mean, a lot of what she does, yes, does she act on her own? Absolutely. And by the end of it, ultimately, yes, she's the one involved in the final fight, if you will. But in betwixt and in between, she's doing the whole like Big Brother thing. She's surveillance technology and she's pulling strings just like her master pulls strings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she's a really compelling character because she does both kinds of bad.
True. Yes. And in terms of Ana de Armas, she was one of the top things in terms of the list from the studios of what not to mention, because in the trailers, Ana de Armas seems to be almost like a replicant. She's some type of robot. She's something that, you know, he ends up finding, or he ends up falling in love with, or, well, in all reality, Ana de Armas plays a computer program that is mass sold to consumers all over wherever, to give people companion. It's a companion software. And so this program just creates a hologram of this, you know, her character role in your household.
Which is super, super well executed in every regard, by the way. The subtlety of seeing the scene through her almost every moment that she's on screen, the detail that goes into that is remarkable.
Here's the only thing that I have with that particular aspect of it. I don't mind that it was kept as a secret and it's just, you know, one of those things where like, okay, we're going to, you know, it's, you know, it is what it is. But here's the thing. If people are going to look at this, and this might be me being on my soapbox, but if people are going to look at this and say, oh, this was great, this was whatever, this has the same dynamic of that movie that came out a few years back called Her, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson. And people pooped all over that movie because they thought it was just ridiculous garbo. And I'm like, I saw the film. I thought it was actually unique. I thought it was a very well done film in terms of creating this relationship between humans and AIs, or even just artificial intelligence.
I was going to say, Her is not even the first of its kind that.
No.
The visual treatment and some things that they do in this film obviously harken back to that.
Yeah. And so I'm really hoping that people kind of see that and exactly have the same epiphany that you had. This isn't the first time this has happened, that if they want to see films that really dive into that aspect, which is ultimately what society is all about, we're practically in love with our electronics. And so, you know, if you love it so much, why don't you marry it, kind
of
deal.
The meta context of one who was built to do someone else's bidding then also has a program that's even less human than he is to be the person that he wants it to be, the person, the being that he wants it to be. I mean, like, the meta commentary on that
Man,
is...
Man, Chad, you're just pulling back layers, aren't you?
Wild. I mean, it's really compelling. Again, something that works really, really well watching it the third time off of the DVD at home or streaming it online or whatever. But the first time sitting in the theater, some of it just takes a little while when it doesn't have to. Some of the, you know, the... You're given to believe that he comes home from his job as an officer, as a Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
He comes home every day and talks to her, to Joy is the name of the program. And he pours her a glass of beverage, or pretends to, and of course she's not going to drink it because she's not physically there. They talk, he... you know, does like odds and ends housework and, you know, whatever, daily errands and tasks and things as if they're doing them together. And then you've got like these lingering moments of as if they're going to hold hands or whatever. And the hands actually overlay each other rather than just simply meet as if her hand is actually there. And it's visually, it's very stunning, but it's done so slow. It almost feels like this is the first and only time that he's done this.
Yeah.
Versus the feeling of this is what he does. This is his routine. This is what he does every day. And I think that they linger upon it for the effect it's going to have on the audience. But to your point, some of those aspects have been seen before and or they're really easy to understand visually.
Yeah.
So you don't need for it to take 12 seconds when it can take 3.
Yeah. And, unfortunately, kind of, and
it all adds up.
Exactly. I don't know if you're kind of catching that common thread that we're talking about, but the film is not bad story-wise. The journey that you go on from beginning to end in terms of what it's trying to convey, the message, according to Chad here, the subcontext of the majority of the scenes that you're grasping at, it's not, they're not poorly executed. What is poorly executed is the pacing and the length of time that is used for all this to be delivered to the consumer. And that is where the problem lies. And I don't think it's funny because you think about going back to Villeneuve, you think about his filmography and you think about a lot of the films, like one of the films that you talk about in great length, actually, because I have yet to see it, but I know you've seen it on more than one occasion, is Prisoners.
Yes.
And Prisoners itself,
that's a brutal movie.
It's also a film that's more than 2 hours. I know it's more than...
Yeah, I don't remember how long. It feels long because it's hard to watch. It's a difficult story. But we were talking a few days ago about, you know, Prisoners, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049. I mean, you've got this... visually, I think that there's a decently unified language. The whole like putting a lot of detail into the scene and making sure that those details are noticeable and stuff like that, that he's really, really good at that. Getting the right team around him and then showing what he wants to show on screen. But then, you know, a movie like Prisoners, even in the quiet moments, it's so tense.
Mm.
Like there's so much tension because of what the story is about. That it doesn't really, to me at least, it didn't feel like the movie is dragging. in the times when you're watching a character think or, you know, fight through the implications of a decision or, you know, whatever. If all you're doing is watching, you know, Hugh Jackman's character give in to the temptation to go get alcohol at the liquor store, you know, or to do something and it takes a little while for you to watch that, you're still like, you're so emotionally invested in what has happened to him and his family.
Yeah.
That if that movement, that emotional movement takes a minute to show on screen and you could have technically done it in 15 seconds, okay, sure, you could have, but it doesn't feel overdrawn. I think in this movie, and similarly in Arrival, I think that there were moments in Arrival that were drawn out, but to, you know, very good effect. I think in this movie, you have a whole lot of things that are drawn out mainly to call attention to how beautiful it is, or how visually distinctive. I won't say beautiful necessarily. Not every scene is beautiful. Not every setting is beautiful. But the way that they treat lighting and shadow, and the way that they treat the saturation of colors, and things like that, it absolutely deserves your eyeballs.
Oh yeah,
For a while.
Because and that's another key part of the film, the color palette that it maintains. Although it tries to maintain this subdued gray, bleak, just tone overall in terms of just the way the world is and how dystopic everything is right now, and after the great blackout and all these incidences that happened that have caused the world to not be the shining light that it used to be, you still get opportunities where unique color shines through and it pops. Mm-hmm. Like yellows are bright yellows, oranges are deep oranges, your blues, your purples, your reds, you know, it's very distinct amidst the gray backdrop.
Well, and it's still so because it's not the colors do pop, but it's not like What Dreams May Come.
No.
You know, it's not like candy coated. It's still very gritty and realistic, and they're deep colors. They're dark versions of colors because of the filters on the camera or the post-production process or all of the above, you know, whatever it may be. You know, like the yellows, for example, one of the things that I was doing as we were prepping for the show was, oh, I want to talk about this building in the real world that really exists. So the Wallace Corporation,
yeah.
Whenever you're inside there, it's incredibly distinctive, because there's water going on, there's different levels of the floors, the light constantly shifts and moves across the backdrop and across the characters' faces while they're interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of shadow in addition to the light, and there's, you know, those bright yet deep yellows.
Yeah.
Oftentimes in that setting. And all I could think about was a Facebook video that I saw for the first time about 3 weeks ago, of a structure in Abu Dhabi, that is the Louvre Abu Dhabi. The Louvre Abu Dhabi. So they've got Abu Dhabi, obviously, huge presence in the Middle East in terms of like lots of money, lots of development and all kinds of things. And
sports,
so they
cars
are
down the street.
They're importing, like they're going to have a version of the Guggenheim. They're going to have a version of the Louvre, which is nearly finished. So anyway, this video was showing the inside. So the outside and inside. So you should go look this up, dear listeners, Louvre Abu Dhabi, designed by a French dude named Jean Nouvel. And it's basically, if you imagine the sides of the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing from the Olympics of 2008, how they were like crisscrossed, you know, lines basically that looked like a nest. Yeah, imagine that as the roof. So it's a giant saucer roof of all these intersecting lines, and there's no like full covering. So the sunlight breaks in through this all day long and just plays across the walls through the shadows all day long as the sun transverses the sky.
Hmm.
And then some of the rooms inside have water beside the walking paths. So that's reflecting light back onto the walls and the art pieces and everything too. And it's the way that the video made it look, it's incredibly dark on the inside, but has all these like constantly moving lights, natural lights. And that's exactly, to me, the visual feel, look and feel of the Wallace Corporation. I'm like, this is totally that video that I just watched 3 weeks ago. Obviously done with a filmmaking team's flair for, you know, extra saturated rich visuals.
Yeah.
You know, but that whole, you know, and then kind of going on this theme of, well, what if we're supposed to pull meaning out of the very location and setting in addition to the plot points? You know, what does it say, you know, when you've got the new maker of the replicants essentially living and working in this environment of intense shadow with small bits of light, and it's always mercurial and moving, and it's never static. And it's just, I think that there's a lot in the subtext of much of the film that is a whole lot richer than you would pull out on the first viewing. Because the first viewing, honestly, by and large, I mean, I was sitting there thinking, okay, is this going to pick up? And where the heck is Harrison Ford?
Yeah.
I mean, that was like half of my thought process during the first 2 hours of this film. Where is Harrison Ford? Mm-hmm. When are we going to see him? Because you know that he's here in the movie. You've seen the trailers. You've seen the posters. He's on the press junkets. But where is he?
Yeah. It's true. And like you said, there's a lot of subtle, you know, subtle thoughts here and there that are done with each of the scenes. And I mean, you know, just with that particular scene by itself in his little palace, if you will, it's very beautiful. It's very clean. It's almost like static room clean. It's a distinctly different from being outside where there's dust, there's snow, yes, there's something going on. It
constantly
makes
constantly environmental debris everywhere. Exactly. Else.
Yeah, it's quiet compared to the noise. It's serene compared to the chaos. It's really interesting. And mind you, those are all really interesting aspects of the film itself. They're really great points, but the fact still remains is that the film takes 2 hours to establish these particular pieces of information. You recognize this and you spend 45 minutes in his 30 minutes in his, you know, home or whatever it is,
right,
just perusing through information and whatnot, and then you spend so much time here, you spend so much time there. It's so spread out that you almost forget that this is still a point of admiration in the film.
And to your point you made a little bit ago, he's not really the main bad guy. I mean, like, mm-mm, in a way, while I think he was more interesting here, and again, people are going to hate, I think he was more interesting here than he was in Suicide Squad. But in a way, it's the Joker from Suicide Squad all over again. You were promised that Jared Leto was going to be this, you know, major force of antagonism, and really it's his lieutenant that's doing everything. He's just kind of showing up every now and again.
Even to the point, like
he's mostly
said,
aloof and self-absorbed, and he himself individually doesn't really pose much of a threat.
No.
Most of the time.
And like you said, it is the lieutenant to Jared Leto's character who is in the final battle of the film that, you know, Ryan Gosling is going back and forth with. And so we're not going to go too far into that information. I mean, mind you, if you'd like, you can suffer through 2 hours.
You know,
and
suffice
minutes,
it to say, plot aside, Roger Deakins is a genius.
Yes, Roger Deakins is the man.
Give the man every possible award that he could qualify for.
I don't know where his inspiration comes from, but for a lot of these scenes, they look like art pieces. Like, yes, if you can pause the Blu-ray, because you're going to want to see this on Blu-ray, you don't want to go to the theaters. But if you could pause the Blu-ray and just leave your television screen on that scene, it is a beautiful work of art that you can just pick all the little subtle nuances that he incorporates with his scene composition. It's really incredible. And we had just seen a YouTube video, you know, talking to great length about Roger Deakins not too long ago, and knowing more so that he's the man behind a lot of these great, you know, film compositions and the scene, the cinematography for most of them, you can see where a lot of his inspiration draws from. You can see where a lot of his progress through film and you know, his ideas for creating great film composition, where they derive from.
So. And you can tell, I really think, obviously, there's a lot about this film that does rely on special effects and, you know, post-produced image treatments and everything. However, that being said, I think it's very obvious when you know what you're looking for, you can absolutely see how much work went into the initial capture of the scene. Like, the cinematography, the lighting, the blocking of the scenes, everything. Like, you can see how unbelievably precise and polished things were in the camera before sending it to the editing bay and all the, you know, the computers to post-produce things and add digital graphics here and there and recolor sequences and all that. Like, so much of the work was actually done on set, and I think you can tell it.
Oh yeah, no doubt. And it's one of those things that actually was easily able to translate in all the teasers and trailers and you know, yeah. So all in all, what was your final impression of the film after leaving the theater for 3 hours?
Well, I want to give us each a pat on the back because we promised spoilers and we have avoided most of the important ones.
It's true.
Including the entire journey of Ryan Gosling's character, which is actually the focal point of the story. He's your point of view character, and many of the twists involved in the story have to do with his perception of what's happening and how that shifts over time. You know, is Pinocchio a real boy? Has he been a real boy the whole time and didn't know it?
Yeah.
Or if not, then why does he know some of the things that he knows? And I mean, there's a lot of complexity that just takes a little long. It's just a little long telling you each of these things and letting him go through those experiences. But it is still a complex. You definitely, as an audience member, I think, you kind of go along for the ride.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this is going to be one of those kinds of stories. And then it twists again and you're like, oh, this is going to be one of those kinds of stories. And where are we going to end up? And
yeah.
And where the heck is Harrison Ford? Because again, he doesn't show up until almost 2 hours into this movie.
Yeah.
When he does, I will say, when he does, it is so refreshing because everything finally picks up. Once he's there, because he's, you know, he's gruff and he's Harrison Ford. I mean, he's just, he's so, it's the perfect dynamic and it should have been introduced far earlier. But his presence in the film really does finally catalyze and speed things up that were going very slowly before. And everything just moves from that moment on. And it's refreshing because you're like, oh, so we sat through the first 2 hours that could have been really an hour and 15 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
But now these last 45 minutes are really going to move, and they really do.
Yeah.
And that leaves you feeling more fulfilled than you felt like you were on track to feel. So all that to say, overall, I'm going to give it a pass. It's just too darn beautiful to not give it a pass. It is incredible. We didn't talk about the whole like hologram overlay of a human being sequence. I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi stuff in here that's really fulfilling. I mean, it's a new way of presenting certain ideas visually, a new way of presenting ideas. And that is all very refreshing. So I'm going to give it a pass. I'm only going to give it 3 out of 5 monocles because I really think it should have gone faster. It just, as beautiful as it is, save it for the special features, some of it. Like, let us get those long lingering shots in the special features.
Yeah.
as part of like the concept, the moving concept gallery or something, you know, the artistry behind Blade Runner 2049 or like,
yeah.
But in terms of the pacing of a movie, it should have gone a little bit smoother and a little bit faster.
And I have to agree with the component of Ryan Gosling. My only misstep for that is Harrison Ford played more of a noir styled detective in the first film. So there was a lot more of the unique questioning, almost like the smoky alley, you know, back alley interrogation from the PI. And Harrison Ford did that really well in the first film. In this film, in this aspect, not so much. He does try with some of the lingo, with some of the dialogue, you know, when he presents his hologram with the president, and he's like, well, why don't we just say it's our anniversary? And she's like, it's our anniversary? He's like, no, but why don't we just say it is? Yeah, you know, that right. kind of alludes to that mentality, that type of style of genre that we talked about last week. But he doesn't really hit that.
No, this really doesn't lean into the noir. Like, yes, it's a detective trying to put pieces together and solve a mystery or whatever, but it really, the first one leans into that noir
yeah.
vibe, and this one, I don't think it really does.
No. And mind you, it doesn't state that this is what it's going to be, but as a continuation of the first film, you would assume that spirit of that particular character or that particular role would carry over.
Yeah.
So it does kind of fall short, as well as in the area like we talked about with the time. I love the film because of the fact of the continuation of the similar universe. I think Villeneuve really hits home when it comes to creating a universe that is still alive and well, even after 35 years, being able to pinpoint exactly you know, where that era, where that universe is in the modern day time frame, according to the universe there. He really falls well into Ridley Scott's world, and it comes off really well.
So how many monocles?
So
I'm assuming you mean that it's going to pass for you. So yeah, you liked it.
It will pass.
Yeah.
I will give it 4, half a monocle for Ryan Gosling and half a monocle for the time, giving it 4 monocles. Like I said, I really still enjoyed the movie. I liked being able to follow this story from beginning to end and just being engrossed. I found myself, you know, captured by the story, but I can totally state that it did go on far too long.
And I will say 2 quick other things. One of them, San Diego, I'm so sorry that you were turned into a garbage dump. Like, literally all of San Diego is a garbage dump.
The garbage dump for LA.
And so that's really upsetting because San Diego is beautiful. And number 2, sorry, spoiler alert. And then number 2, the ending of this film, the only thing that I can compare it to, and I know that this is not very fair, because what came before, like the way the film is made, is obviously superior to what I'm about to reference. But it's the only thing in my arsenal that I can think of feeling the same. By the end of this film, where you end up actually feels like the true beginning of a legacy story, if you will, from the first one. And so you're going through the whole thing. It's beautiful. It's slow and whatever. And you're trying to find all the things to appreciate so that, you know, you keep your own attention, even when the movie's not doing the best job of keeping your attention for you.
Yeah.
And then you get to the end, and the only thing that I could think of was, oh my gosh, this is like the Golden Compass all over again.
Oh,
because the Golden Compass.
Come on.
Hold on. The Golden Compass takes you through a whole sequence and series of events, and then in the end, they all end up on a boat together, and they're going to start their adventure. And, like, number one, I was annoyed by that movie almost from the get-go. But number two, you literally got to the end of the movie, and that was the start of the actual story. Like, the entire movie was essentially a prequel to a story that never happened because everybody hated that movie and they didn't end up making another one. I hope that doesn't happen here, because I think that the world that they've built is incredibly compelling. There's definitely room for the story to continue at the end of this one, but I think that there is a sense of oh, wait a minute. So this movie was just getting ready to launch you into the actual story, like the existential story of, you know, the humans and the replicants. You've got a lot of touches of, you know, there's going to be some kind of an uprising or whatever that doesn't happen, because the thing that everybody needs is this child, whoever the child was that, you know, Rachel's exhumed bones indicate was brought into the world, right? And various different players know or are interested in knowing where the child ended up and who the child is.
Yeah.
And that's the central mystery of the story. You do get the answer by the end of the movie, and then the movie's over. So I think to a certain degree, it has a similar feel to me as The Golden Compass, not in terms of quality, but in terms of the end result doesn't feel very fulfilling, because I, you know, you sit there for almost 3 hours and suddenly you're ready for, you know, the story proper to kick into gear, and that, you know, you're actually ending this movie, and who knows if they'll make another one.
It's true. But that about wraps up another awesome review of this film. If you have any thoughts about it, if you saw it this weekend and you're you don't agree, or you do agree, or you just want to say hello, drop us a line on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers, or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a little bit of movie news. The final trailer to The Last Jedi dropped during Monday Night Football. Are you ready for some trailers? Sorry, I had to do that.
I liked it. And it's phenomenal.
It is.
It's an incredible, incredible trailer.
Yep. It dropped earlier this week for The Last Jedi, with only a little bit more than 2 months until the release date. This trailer gives fans a closer glimpse at the epic journey to come in December. Oddly enough, Rian Johnson had taken to Twitter to address the fans concerned about the trailer, stating that he is, quote, legitimately torn, and that if you want to come in clean, absolutely avoid it. But then he kind of recanted after that, saying, forget everything I said and watch it, watch it, watch it. And of course, we watched it. The trailer is really great. It really does give you a lot of little nuggets that if you're like somebody like us, you'll comb through and sift through for like days on end and try to find all the little...
Oh yeah, there's a lot to appreciate in this thing.
Oh yeah, and I kid you not, I've been doing that already for some time. So yeah, check it out if you can. We'll probably we'll post it on our Facebook page so you can take a look. But yeah, that about wraps up another awesome episode. Just to let you know, a couple of weekend releases. Happy Death Day comes out this Friday, as well as Marshall.
Pass.
And Professor...
For the first one. Marshall first actually one. Looks good.
That's why I jumped over Happy Death Day. I was like, yeah, but it is coming out. Marshall and Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. So those films debut this Friday. So if you get a chance, check them out. Or if you would like to go check out The Last Jedi, Blade Runner 2049, and let us know your thoughts, by all means, do that as well. This was fun. This was great. Of course, we're not going to fully agree on the film, but we do agree on some points. And you know, it's still, this conversation was still civil. I didn't have to jump over the table. I think we're good.
As if you would. I would love to see you try. No, I'm kidding. It's all good.
It was great. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.